From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Hi, and I'm Tom Ahidi, a father of two young girls, and tomorrow I will start a three-month sentence as a prisoner of conscience for protesting at the School of the Americas.
24 School of the Americas protesters are beginning their prison terms on Tuesday. 20,000 people turn out at a rally for the peaceful at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. We'll talk to hip-hop artist Michael Franti. And then a look back at the Earth Summit, earthsummit.biz, the corporate takeover of sustainable development. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration over the weekend dramatically escalated its PR campaign calling for an attack on Iraq. On Friday, President Bush called the leaders of Russia, China, and France and tried unsuccessfully to gain their support. The Kremlin spokesperson said Putin expressed serious doubts that there are grounds for the use of force, and the foreign minister said an attack on Iraq could undermine efforts to combat international terrorism. French President Jacques Chirac and German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder met the next day and said any military action must have the approval of the United Nations. Schroeder went further, rejecting any attack on Iraq, even if the U.S. has U.N. backing. And a senior member of Schroeder's governing Social Democrats accused President Bush of behaving like a Roman emperor, Caesar Augustus. White House officials said not to take the French and Russian public statements too literally. On Saturday morning, President Bush met with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. They claim there's ample evidence that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Blair said, quote, "We only need look at the report from the International Atomic Energy Agency this morning, showing what has been going on at a former nuclear weapons site." But by the evening, the existence of a new report with satellite photos showing Iraqi nuclear construction was being denied by officials at the International Atomic Energy Agency, the National Security Council, and the White House. Atomic Energy Agency spokesman Mark Gwazdecki said the agency has been reviewing the commercial satellite photos in question for more than 2 years and that there's no new evidence of Iraqi nuclear activity. He said, quote, "Bush and Blair are going off of a New York Times article on Friday that really didn't get it right. In fact, we issued a press release last night saying there's no new information about any Iraqi nuclear activity, and until we get inspectors on the ground, we can't draw any conclusion," unquote. On Sunday, President Bush deployed five members of his war cabinet to the talk shows, where they adopted nearly identical language in a new united front. They suggested Bush would accept a last-chance effort by the United Nations to deploy weapons inspectors in Iraq, but that Bush is still committed to a timetable so rapid he may ask Congress to authorize military force within weeks. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting White House officials are following a meticulously planned strategy to persuade the public, the Congress, and the allies of the need to attack Iraq. The officials are claiming the rollout of the strategy this week was not hastily concocted after some prominent Republicans began to raise doubts. The White House chief of staff, who's coordinating the effort, Andrew Card, said, quote, "From a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August." White House officials say a centerpiece of the strategy is to use Bush's speech on September 11th to bolster support for an attack. Chief White House political advisor Karl Rove said, quote, "Everybody felt that was a moment that Americans want to hear from him, to seize the moment to make clear what lies ahead." Toward that end, the White House picked Ellis Island in New York Harbor for Bush's September 11th speech. The television camera angles were most spectacular there, where the Statue of Liberty will be seen glowing behind Bush. His September 11th remarks are to serve as the emotional precursor for a tougher speech at the United Nations General Assembly the following day. The White House has dispatched envoys to Moscow, Beijing, and Paris for follow-up discussions to the UN speech. The Scottish Sunday Herald is reporting the U.S. and Britain sold Saddam Hussein the technology and materials Iraq needed to develop nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons of mass destruction. U.S. Senate reports reveal that the U.S., under Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr., sold materials to Iraq, including anthrax, VX nerve gas, West Nile fever germs, botulism, and other germs until March 1992, after the Gulf War. and former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter addressed the Iraqi National Assembly in Baghdad on Sunday. He said the U.S. seems to be on the verge of making a historical mistake. He said Iraq is not a sponsor of the kind of terror perpetrated against the United States on September 11th and, in fact, is active in suppressing that sort of fundamental extremism. Ritter also said Iraq has been certified as being 90% to 95% disarmed and warned that if the U.S. unilaterally launches any military action against Iraq, it will, quote, forever change the political dynamic which has governed the world since the end of the Second World War, namely the foundation of international law as set forth in the United Nations Charter, which calls for the peaceful resolution of problems between nations. Again, those are the words of UN Chief Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter, who was in Iraq. The news from eastern Afghanistan, at least 15 soldiers and civilians died and more than 50 were wounded in a battle between government forces and supporters of the warlord Padshah Khan Zadran yesterday. The battle started when a local radio station in Khost announced Zadran had been arrested by U.S. forces. And it's emerged that an 18-year-old market vendor saved Afghan President Hamid Karzai from assassination last week. When a man dressed as an Afghan army guard began shooting at Karzai, Azimullah Mohammed jumped on the guard. U.S. Special Forces then apparently shot them both dead. The governor of Kandahar was injured in the attack. His spokesperson said that if Azimullah Mohammed had not been there, the soldier would have easily assassinated Karzai. It had been widely reported in the Western media that U.S. Special Forces saved the Afghan president. Newsweek magazine is reporting one of the FBI's informants actually lived with two of the September 11th hijackers. The connection has just been discovered by congressional investigators and has stunned some top counterterrorism officials and raised new concerns about the information sharing among law enforcement and intelligence agencies. FBI Director Robert Mueller initially insisted there was nothing the Bureau could have done to penetrate the 911 plot.
We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees.
Do I have to leave?
We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, no, no, no. Whoa, no, no, no. Violence brings one thing, more and more of the same. Military madness, the smell of flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses, stand up if you're still sane. To all of us gone crazy, I sing this one refrain. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.
Michael Franti singing this weekend at Golden Gate Park at a protest rally, Power to the Peaceful. Between 10 and 20,000 people gathered at the park in San Francisco for a day-long rally and concert to call for peace on Saturday. The 911 Power to the Peaceful Festival brought together musicians, artists, activists committed to social justice and against war. The festival was first held 4 years ago to call attention to Mumia Abu-Jamal's impending execution, the date 9-1-1, chosen to note the emergency status of Mumia's case. But after last year's attack, the date 9-1-1 took on wider significance. The day began with a moment of peaceful meditation. Among the people who were there, KRS-One, candidates, Green Party, former candidate Jello Biafra, Mario Africa from MOVE, Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange. Before the whole event began, I had a chance to speak with hip-hop artist Michael Franti.
Well, the first year was Mumia 911, and it was the International Day of Art and Culture for Mumia. And so there was people all around the world that put on painting exhibitions, plays, and what we did in San Francisco is a musical manifestation. And so we had an event, a concert, and we used 911 to draw attention to the emergency status of Mumia's case, so that we used those numbers. And then in 2000, we did another concert that was expanded to be in opposition to the prison industrial complex as a whole. And then last year, obviously, September 11th took on a whole new significance, and it became a peace concert. And what we're doing here this year is really making the statement that, like Martin Luther King said, that peace is not merely the absence of war, but it's the presence of justice. And if we want to develop a lasting peace throughout the world, we're not going to do it through bombing. We're going to do it through social justice. And so today we have gathered over 100 different social justice organizations who are representing here today. Ourselves, Spearhead, Karis One is here, Mystic is here, a lot of other great musicians and artists and speakers and performers.
How has 911 affected your music and the response to it?
Well, in two ways. One is that I feel like it's really important that the musical community leads the voice for peace. We don't hear it in the corporate media. Even in some of the alternative media, we don't hear the voice of peace coming through. And I think it's important for artists to, in this time, be there to enrage, enlighten, and inspire people to work for peace. And so the way that my music has changed is that, you know, I've written some songs that are about those issues, but I've really tried to dig deep in my music to touch an emotional core, because I feel that that's the way music works the best. There's scientific reasoning, and there's, you know, political polls and all those things that work good in that field, but what we do as musicians is try to work with emotions.
How do you link the two issues? How do you link your 911 events before 911, which really focused on critical resistance, the prison industrial complex, Mumia, Abu Jamal, and what's happening now?
Mm-hmm. Well, ironically, those attacks took place on the same day we were putting our concert, so we didn't have to reach very far to try to link them together. But the way that they're really linked is that, you know, the budget surplus that was accumulated during the Clinton administration has now gone into, quote-unquote, homeland security. It's gone into bombing people in other parts of the world, and it's gone into the pockets of militarists. And that same money we've been speaking out for to go into the schools and to go into social services and to go into promoting clean living and clean energy. And instead of the prison industrial complex and instead of the military.
Can you talk about Bomb the World?
Well, I have a song called Bomb the World, and the lyrics is, we can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. And I think that it's important that the focus shift from just revenge for these attacks and just revenge on or at first strike against people that we think may have these weapons of mass destruction. I'm like, well, what were the weapons that we dropped in Afghanistan? It caused plenty of mass destruction there. And I believe strongly that we need to have young people. We need to have middle American people. We need to have as many people as we can to raise our voices and say that if our goal is lasting peace in the world and lasting safety in the world, that we're not going to get it through bombing.
There are all sorts of activities that are taking place around the country, and people are talking about a crackdown as well around the country. Even in just putting together your concert, how are the police dealing with this?
Well, 2 days ago, the police, we had they called us into an emergency meeting and said that we've heard that this event is going to be 15,000 to 20,000 people, and we need you to hire two more squadrons of police officers. And we hadn't hired any to begin with, but they told us that that would cost us $7,500, and that if we didn't have this money, that our concert couldn't go.
You have to hire public
police?
We have
to hire them. And my argument to them was, well, People are supposed to have equal protection under the law. If the KKK throws a march or a rally or a political event, the police come out and protect them. If we're doing a direct action, like say at the WTO, we shouldn't have to pay for police and riot gear to come beat us up. We're putting on a very peaceful event here that we've had done for 4 years without any problems, and this year they're just, you know, sticking it to us, and there's nothing that we could do. We're just going to have to try to fight it after the fact.
So how much are you supposed to pay?
$7,500.
So this would scare other people if they want to put on an event.
Yeah. Basically, that's what it's about. You know, they're trying to, you know, strong arm us into doing this. And we've tried, you know, we've called our supervisors and everybody that we can, people at the mayor's office, the previous police captain in another district that we did the event last year, who didn't charge us anything, and tried to get all their support, but it's not been working.
You're listening to Michael Franti, hip-hop artist.
When the president-select comes to town, when there's a political rally, do they charge people?
I don't know. I mean, in the past, we've never had us be charged at any other political events that we've done, and so I don't know why they've chosen this. You know, I understand the concern. You know, if there's a whole bunch of people that are coming, and the last thing a police captain wants is if somebody gets hurt, to say, well, why didn't you have police out there? But no one's, you know, we pay for it in our taxes, and it's supposed to be part of what we buy, you know. So I don't know. I guess if they come out here, I'm going to put them to work, man.
Did you get to deduct money that you've paid if they do beat anyone up?
I don't know. I don't think that'll happen. I mean, this is not that type of event. But I mean, last year they came out and they stood around and they clapped and they danced and they had fun, you know. And I don't think we should have to pay them $7,500 for that. If anything, they should be paying us.
If you have to pay, maybe you can get them without the frills, like without the tear gas, without the batons,
no,
maybe without the guns.
I think there's only one standard issue that you get.
In talking to other musicians, as you travel nonstop around the country now, how many are putting out the message that you are, and how many feel free to do that?
Well, there's very few that are really putting out this message, but we're hoping that it'll be more. And we're really excited that KRS-One came on board. You know, he called me last week and said, hey, I really want to be there. So he flew himself up from L.A. I was really excited to see that Michelle and DeGocella just popped up out here, just unannounced, and now we're going to try and get her up on stage. And so we're hoping that, first of all, we're hoping that we don't go into Iraq, but we're hoping that if we do go into Iraq, that the musical community will really stand up and be counted for.
Michael Franti, hip-hop artist, power to the peaceful rally, musical concert, and protest on Saturday at Golden Gate Park. It was broadcast live by Pacifica Station KPFA and Hard Knocks Radio. A shout-out to them. When we come back, we'll hear Jello Biafra, a former Green Party candidate who took the stage on Saturday. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Come on, put your hands in the air like this. Put your hands in the air like this. Everybody now, put your hands in the air like this. Yo. We're living in a mean time, in an aggressive time, a painful time, a time where cynicism robs the vine, in a time where violence blocks the sun, will shine like times. Go buy in the flesh, in a search for love, in a search for cash. Everybody wanna be some fat tycoon. Everybody wanna be on a tropic honeymoon. Nobody wanna sing a little bit out of tune, or be the backbone of a rebel platoon. It's too soon. Step out of line, you might get laughed at, you might get fine, but do you feel me when I say I feel pain every day when I see the way my friends gotta slay and never get ahead of bills they gotta pay. No way, no way. Some make a living doing killing, Colombian penicillin. Some are willing to play the villain, they just chilling to pass the time, pass the information or pass the wine, pass the buck or pass the baton. But you can't pass the police or the Pentagon, the IRS or the upper echelon. It's time to make a move on the country, shut bomb bomb. Rock the nation, took over television and radio station, bomb bomb. A true shotgun, keep the corporations of complication, bomb bomb. Rock the nation, took over television and radio station, bomb bomb. A true shotgun, keep the corporations of complication.
Michael Franti at the Power to the Peaceful rally on Saturday. 20,000 people packed Golden Gate Park. You are listening to Democracy Now! This is Resistance Radio. Later in the program, we'll speak with Kenny Bruno, who's just returned from South Africa, about EarthSummit.biz, the corporate takeover of sustainable development. We'll also be speaking with a man who's going to prison tomorrow for protesting the School of the Americas, protesting state terror. But right now, we turn to Jello Biafra. Among other things, he was nominated for the Green Party presidential primary in New York State, former lead singer-songwriter for the political punk band Dead Kennedys, renowned spoken word performer and social commentator, took the stage on Saturday.
Thank you. The most important thing to keep in mind about this so-called upcoming invasion of Iraq to go kill Saddam Hussein and who knows how many hundreds of thousands of innocent men, women, and children in the process, is that it hasn't happened yet. It hasn't started yet, and we still have time to stop it. And right now, it seems a little lonely out there. Our corporate media is saying, oh, America loves to go to war. Everybody in the world is behind us and wants us to go to war and rescue them from Saddam Hussein. Well, obviously that's a little off the mark. The minute you go across the Canadian border, across the ocean, you find things are very different. But point is, it feels a little lonely and almost helpless at the moment to try and actually get a message to the nuts who are running our country right now. But that's the same thing that was happening in 1964 when another rubber-stamped, spineless Democrat Congress gave President Lyndon Johnson the go-ahead to do whatever he wanted in Vietnam. And those lonely voices in the wilderness who said, yo, this war is wrong. This war is going to blow up in our face, and a lot of innocent people, including American kids, are going to die. They were put down as traitors, communists. And we'd just been through the Cuban Missile Crisis, so there was a little bit of an argument for that. They were put down as freaks, peaceniks, pinkos, faggots. That's me, that's me, he says. However, against incredible, seemingly insurmountable odds, with the whole military-industrial complex and the hierarchies of both the Democratic and Republican parties aiming against the American people with both barrels, the American people rose up and did stop the Vietnam War. We've done it once. We can do it again. We have no choice. We must do it again to prevent what I think would probably be the biggest foreign policy mistake in any of our lifetimes, worse than Vietnam. But again, there is still time to stop this. Support is already dwindling. Even the Wicked Witch of San Francisco, Senator Dianne Feinstein, came out forcefully against the invasion a couple days ago. This means it is not too late, as hopeless as it sounds, to write letters to our Congress creatures. Hold Dianne's feet to the fire on this one so she doesn't turn tail when the money looks too good. And also, keep in mind that across Europe, most people in those countries and even most of their leadership, including the right-wing government of France.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Jello Biafra speaking at a rally of 20,000 at Golden Gate Park this past weekend in California, San Francisco. And if you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. As we go back now to the politician, musician, former lead singer-songwriter for the political punk band Dead Kennedys.
Why this war is wrong and how important it is to pull the plug on the War on Terrorism Incorporated right now. Number one, forgive the flags. I know how threatening it can feel to see the stars and stripes used the same way the swastika was used several decades ago, and it can be very intimidating. But not everybody with the flags in their windows and the flags on their cars is doing it for that reason. We do have freedom of speech in this country, and some of the people flying the flags are doing it in sympathy for the innocent people who were killed on September 11th. So let them have the flags. But the way to get through, even to the people with the flags, maybe even with the flags on their SUVs, is to point out that the War on Terrorism Incorporated and the invasion of Iraq scam, in the long run, are piss poor military strategy. I don't like Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein or religious fundamentalists or what the Islamic fundamentalists do to women, especially, either. I want to be safe from terrorism, too, but right now, all we're doing over there, every time we drop a bomb, every time we kill somebody, level somebody's town, and say we have no responsibility to rebuild it, we're planting the seeds for more Osama bin Ladens, more Al-Qaedas, more suicide bombers, thus making our own country and our own lives less and less and less safe. That is a textbook definition of piss-poor military strategy. That's not what I would call homeland security, somehow. And that's the way to get through to the people even waving the flags who say George Bush is a wonderful guy of infinite wisdom. My girlfriend has this stepmother back in Ohio who's so rah-rah Bush Republican Party, she's devoted a wing of the trophy home she lives in to a Republican Party museum. Every American flag ever made, Reagan memorabilia, King George I memorabilia, Newt Gingrich's underwear, I suppose, who knows? But even she stopped when my girlfriend said to her over the Christmas holidays, what we're doing in the Middle East is poor military strategy, and it's going to come back and literally blow up in our face. Even that woman stopped and said, you know, that's a good point. That is how to get through to people that the war on terrorism is wrong and needs to be actively opposed before it's expanded into Iraq. Don't hate the media, become the media. Not just supporting independent gatherings and festivals like this one, not just hitting the streets to send a message to George Bush and Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi that the war cannot go on, but now not just supporting the independent and underground magazines, pirate radio, pirate TV, Democracy Now, whatever, becoming the media means going one-on-one to people you know, at home, at school, work, family, and if they start spouting the government party line or resigning themselves that there's nothing we can do to stop this ridiculous war, don't dismiss them as being unreachable. Talk to them. Point out why it's piss-poor military strategy, and maybe we ought to go about our stopping terrorism in a more intelligent and humane manner so as to prevent more terrorism. On top of that, since a lot of them are concerned about not being able to put food on the table, then point out to them it's not the welfare cheats, the eco-terrorists, the feminists, or whatever. It's the NAFTA treaty, fake free trade, and the privatization and selling out our government functions to private corporations, and the way each one of us can fight back as an individual, and this is the easiest thing to turn other people onto when you become the media, don't give them your money. It's not that hard to not give money anymore to chain restaurants, chain box stores, chain stores in general. Put your money back into the independent stores, back into the neighborhood, and back into the community. And it can be almost like a drug or getting tattooed. The more you do it, the more you want to do it. It's simple. The fight against corporate power long term is like the fight against the Vietnam War. We keep pushing. We keep turning other people onto it. In our lifetime, it can be done. Right now, priority is stopping the war. Go to everybody you know as individual members of the media. As they say in show business, we ain't got a lot of time right now to stop this. Let's roll. Thanks for listening.
And that was Jello Biafra speaking at the Power to the Peaceful rally in San Francisco on Saturday. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and there are lots of alternative events that are taking place as we lead up now to September 11th and the observances. And if you're engaged in one of those, or you just want to let us know what you're doing on September 11th, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us and leave a message at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. Or you can email us at 911@democracynow.org. That's 911@democracynow.org. On Wednesday, at the time 1 year ago when the planes hit the World Trade Center, the first tower and then the second, and then both came tumbling down, we are going to be doing a four-hour broadcast from the firehouse, joining with Democracy Now!, WBAI, Wake Up Call, and that will be part of a day-long programming on Pacifica Radio Stations, 13 hours of historic programming on that day, so do tune in. But right now, we turn to tomorrow, when a group of 23 human rights activists will begin serving prison sentences of 3 to 6 months. Their first full day in jail will be September 11th. Their crime? They attempted to shut down what they considered to be what they called a terrorist training camp operated by the U.S. military known as the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. For decades, the school in Fort Benning, Georgia, has trained hundreds of Latin American soldiers and military leaders, originally known as the School of the Americas, from which the camp gained its nickname, School of the Assassins. Graduates include members of the Salvadoran Death Squad, who slaughtered 6 Jesuit priests, their housekeeper and her daughter, on November 16, 1989. 19 of the 26 Salvadoran officers involved in the slayings trained at Fort Benning. In 1996, the Pentagon was forced to release training manuals from the school that advocated the use of torture, extortion, and execution. To commemorate the massacre in El Salvador and other SOA-related crimes, over 10,000 people gathered last November at Fort Benning to call for the closure of the school. Nearly 40 people were arrested on trespassing for walking into the military's property. They were charged with sentences ranging from 6 months probation to 6 months in prison, plus $5,000 fines. Among them was a man named Tom Mahidi. Jimmy Breslin wrote about Tom Mahidi in the last few weeks, Jimmy Breslin of Newsday newspaper. He said, "We're going to need so many like him. Suddenly you live in a country that has an official secret court and the public is mainly unaware and silent." Mahidi has been protesting about this since 1982, his third year in college, when Mothers of the Disappeared in El Salvador came to La Salle University in Philadelphia on a tour. Quote, "I was just coming off 2 years in the ROTC at Auburn University in Alabama," he was saying yesterday. "They told us that the only Central Americans killed were dangerous communists, but when I kept talking to the mothers, I could see they were right and we were wrong." Jimmy Breslin goes on to write about Tom Mahidi. He started out to become a priest. Then he had a part-time job at Newark Airport. And he was leaving work one night. He saw a young woman, a flight attendant from Continental Airlines, waiting at the bus stop. He asked her if she wanted a lift home. She sure did. He drove her home to Woodbridge. Her name was Julie Fees. They married, had 2 kids. They shared a passion about the school at Fort Benning. Tom drove a truck of farm tools in a caravan from Jersey to El Salvador. He was an election observer in 1993. He thought all this was nice and gave satisfaction and might even be helpful, but the frightening shadow over somebody in a hut in Honduras was cast by the School of the Americas. The soldiers were taught in order to kill union people who interrupted slave labor. When Mahidi was a junior at La Salle in Philadelphia, he taught prisoners at the Holmesburg Penitentiary. "I don't know how much they learn," Tom Mahidi said, "but this time I hope I can teach somebody just by sitting in jail." He joins us in the studio right now. Tom Mahidi, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
So tomorrow you leave for prison.
Right.
So why did you do it in November? What exactly did you do?
Well, it's been 20 years of trying to walk in solidarity with the people of the Americas. And last November, I actually went to the base, and I tried to speak for the thousands of people that I've met throughout the years in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala who have been tortured and killed by the graduates, and tried to speak for them. So what we basically did is to walk on the base, and we carried a cross with a family member who was killed, and we were arrested.
Did you know the penalty that you faced?
Well, there is a possibility of jail. This is the first time that they are prosecuting first-timers. But the time is right to speak out against terrorism. And we've been instructed to close all of the bases of terror. And it's clear that, you know, they have been teaching the use of torture and assassination and extortion for years. And we actually had the manuals released from the Pentagon in 1996. So it's an outrage that we continue to have this base and to fund it $20 million a year. There's other ways that we can use that money. And we have to create a world where human rights are respected. And by keeping it open, it's a shock to most people that's happening.
Were you nervous after September 11th to go and protest?
Sure. We have lost many friends on the Jersey Shore, where I'm from, and it's been a time of grieving and of sorrow. And but also, I was taught to open our hearts to the people of the Americas as well. And there's been hundreds of thousands who have been killed and tortured there, and so it was time to speak out for them as well.
We're also joined on the telephone by Ray Kramer. She's a 55-year-old mother from Syracuse. She works in a domestic violence clinic, and she got the harshest sentence of all, 6 months in jail, $5,000 fine. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ray.
Hi. I'm glad to be with you.
Are you prepared to go to jail?
I think so. Part of our privilege in a kind of paradoxical way is that we have friends who have walked this path before us, and so we've had the chance to ask them lots of questions and try to become as informed as possible. So I feel as ready, I think, as one can feel.
Can you talk about the response that people have to you when they learn that you're going to jail?
The response is pretty dramatic. Not simply that we're going to jail, but the length of the sentence and the size of the fine. In my case, I was charged $5,000, which is the max that can be levied against me. And that was, I'm paraphrasing the judge now, because I could afford it. There are a whole variety of papers that one has to fill out as part of the post-booking process or post-trial process, and in it they ask for a lot of financial information, and I was honest. And it's not that I'm rich, far from it, but my husband and I for many years have been kind of squirrels with our money, and we have a lot of money saved and put away for our children and for retirement, and it looked like a lot of money. I think comparatively or proportionately, it's not so much. Many people were levied $1,000 fines who make $10,000 and $15,000 a year. So proportionately, the money was really pretty equitable. The reaction to 6 months and $5,000 fine for peaceful civil disobedience, for walking someplace where I was told not to be, that seems outrageous. And there's an odd quirk in federal law, and that is federal misdemeanors, which is what we are charged with, a misdemeanor, not a felony. There is no allowance for what's called good time, meaning the sentence being reduced if one behaves properly in prison. So those of us who are charged with, sentenced with 6 months, will do the full 6 months. In comparison to a whole variety of local crimes, some of which are quite violent, that get less time, it seems pretty astounding to people. I think that the size of the fine and the size of the time in prison has paradoxically served to energize people a little bit. Their amazement at that this kind of thing can happen in kind of such a casual way, I think, is activating some people. And I can only hope that proves out.
Tom Ahidi, what do your children say? How old are they?
They're 5 and 7. And they were part of the trial, and they met so many wonderful people there that they said, you know, they're very, very sad, as I am, about being separated from each other. But at the same time, they've met wonderful people, and they've been very inspired. And my daughter actually wrote a beautiful poem about the whole experience. And so it's been very difficult, but the analogy is of giving birth. It's painful, but then there's a great new creation that's coming about. And so we talk a lot about, you know, what is our view of the world, you know, a view of love, a view of compassion, a view of healing. And so we try to live that way, you know.
You've also been protesting the bombing of Afghanistan.
Sure.
Where?
We have a base in South Jersey at Fort Monmouth, and we've had a weekly vigil there since September 11th, each week at 12 o'clock in front of Fort Monmouth.
And what is the response of the soldiers there?
The soldiers, it's been mixed. A lot of people, you know, don't agree with going to war who are actually in the military as well. They've been, you know, part of the economic draft. But, you know, and of course others would be opposed.
What do you mean economic draft?
Well, often it's those who, you know, there is less money available for college and for job programs, and so people are forced in. I've talked actually to two people in the past 2 months who don't want to go in but don't see any other options for themselves.
In a few weeks, on September 28th and 29th, there's going to be a major protest in Washington, D.C. against the World Bank and the IMF. Do you see these protests as connected?
Oh, sure. The SOA actually, in their mission statement, state that part of their goal is to carry out the free trade agenda. And so, you know, they are the brutal military force that keeps people in the on the fields and being paid very little. They keep people in the sweatshops. And so I've been involved with the trying to combat the corporate globalization issue because I see the connection with it.
You're wearing a T-shirt that says, "You can jail the resistors, but you can't jail the resistance."
Right. Well, it's true. And even you can't jail love and you can't jail compassion. And that's basically what we're calling about. And we're calling about reconciliation. And I talked to the judge a long time about what are the alternatives to the school. And I talked about having a bereavement camp there. And I talked about having an organic farm there. And I talked about having a symphony hall there. And I talked about life-giving things that we can have at this instead of a place that promotes death and destruction.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Tom Ahidi and Ray Kramer are two people who protested the School of the Americas and are facing months in jail. Ray Kramer, 6 months. And you again, Tom, you'll be serving?
3 months at Fort Dix.
It reminds me of being out in Los Angeles on last Friday night, and I met people who are involved with the Just Dissent movement. It is a bill that was passed by both the California Senate and Assembly that limits the punishment on people who engage in civil disobedience. They're waiting to see if the Governor Gray Davis signs this bill. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
When we come back, EarthSummit.biz, the corporate takeover of sustainable development, the fallout of the Earth Summit in Johannesburg. Stay with us.
I said, what's the word? Tell me about a happy heard about Johannesburg. Somebody tell me what's the word. Tell a woman happy heard from Johannesburg. Tell me that our brothers are over there. I understand a man. And we don't know for sure because the news we get is up and out of a man. Yes, I hate it when the blood starts flowing, but I'm glad to see resistance go ahead.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. I'm looking at a piece that was posted on the Corp Watch website. It says, "Sustainable development is dead. Its demise came, ironically, at the World Summit on Sustainable Development." It's not that the phrase wasn't invoked. It was ad nauseum, but it was hardly discussed. The article goes on to say, "Instead, sustainable development was deemed to be whatever compromise governments happen to reach on trade, subsidies, investment, and aid, and whatever projects corporations see fit to finance. Sustainable development is now officially meaningless." Again, those are the words of Kenny Bruno in a piece he wrote for the organization Corp Watch. Well, as we wrap up with our coverage of the Earth Summit, Kenny Bruno joins us in our Firehouse studio now. He's the co-author with Joshua Carliner of the book EarthSummit.biz, The Corporate Takeover of Sustainable Development. Just around this time last year, the U.S. had just pulled out of the U.N. World Conference on Racism in Durban, South Africa. Now the U.N. Earth Summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, is also drawn to a close among allegations that the U.S. blocked just about every meaningful action on the agenda. Kenny Bruno, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you just returned from Johannesburg.
Yeah, I was there for the summit and some pre-summit events as well.
So talk more about what you wrote.
Well, the book is about the corporate takeover of sustainable development since Rio and about a doctrine that was invented at Rio.
And explain what you mean by Rio.
Rio, the Rio Earth Summit, the first Earth Summit in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro. And at that time, a lot of us, including myself, had tremendous hopes for the idea of sustainable development, for integrating environment and development. But at the same time, a doctrine was brought into the UN whereby instead of trying to monitor corporations and hold them accountable for environmental behavior, that it would seek to partner with corporations and bring them into the UN system. And that doctrine reached its peak at the Johannesburg summit, where corporations really ran the show, and partnership with corporations was the watchword. So, for example, you had the Secretary General Kofi Annan come to the big business day, which gathering of CEOs, and call for an era of partnership. There was a lot of blaming of governments. There was partnership between Shell, for example, was probably the leading corporate so-called corporate environmentalist company that was really calling the shots along with the U.S. government at the summit. And that's really why the summit failed.
Can you talk about Business Day and what you did?
Sure. Business Day was a very high-profile, day-long event, very swanky event, organized by something called the Business Action for Sustainable Development, which was formed for the summit. And it was a bunch of business leaders talking about what great things they were doing for the earth and for poor people, basically posing as leaders in the struggle to eradicate poverty. And if you were to sit there, which I did, and listen to this, you would think that everything is fine. We could just sit back and put our feet up, relax, drink a beer, and business will take care of all the problems. That's the impression they were giving. They were also blaming southern governments especially for the lack of governance or lack of good governance, and blaming southern governments for the problems, which is really ironic considering the governance problems that we're having in corporate America right now. But even worse, even more hypocritical, because those same corporations have been weakening southern governments, have been very busy lobbying to make sure that these governments cannot control and cannot regulate the behavior of corporations. So that was the dynamic. They were pretending that they're our saviors. They care about everything that we care about, and they're going to take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the Greenwash Awards that you gave out?
Yes. Before the summit started, we joined up with Friends of the Earth and Groundwork, which is a South African environmental organization, to form the Greenwash Academy. And we gave out Green Oscars, or Greenwash Academy Awards, to the leading companies that are acting green but not behaving green. And we had a glittering ceremony at a downtown Johannesburg hotel.
We'll talk about the companies and the awards that you gave.
Sure. We gave awards for categories like Best Green Actor for environmental rhetoric and Best Blue Actor. That's for corporate humanitarianism or hiding behind the UN flag and pretending to be a corporate humanitarian company. We also had
Who did you give that out to?
Oh, that went to Nestle for pretending to be allied with the UN, while at the same time Nestle is a company that has been breaking the World Health Organization's Code of Conduct for Marketing of Baby Formula. The green Oscar went to British Petroleum for their new rebranding campaign called Beyond Petroleum. They pretend that they're now Beyond Petroleum.
You mean that BP stands for Beyond Petroleum?
Correct, yes. And they actually, they're still spending billions and billions of dollars looking for new oil and a measly couple of $100 million for solar. But they advertise themselves as Beyond Oil. Actually, they spend more advertising on their environmental record than they do on their environmental projects. So when you spend more on that, that's greenwash. So they got the Greenwash Award for that.
Well, you talked about in the book BP and this campaign that it's on, which is really pushing natural gas.
Right. That's one of the fallacies, is that they're pretending to be beyond petroleum. But what that really means is they're mostly investing in natural gas, which from a climate point of view is hardly any better, if any better at all, than oil itself. The Lifetime Achievement Award went to Shell, of course, because when it comes to greenwash, Shell is simply superb. But it's very interesting because at that business day, I presented a little green Oscar statuette to the chairman of Shell, and I asked him whether he still stood by their behavior in Nigeria as an example of best practices, which in 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit, they put forward their behavior in Nigeria as an example. Best practices, they said. And he said, yes, they're quite proud of their operations in Nigeria. So when I told that to some colleagues from Nigeria in environmental rights action, I mean, they're absolutely outraged. Now, how can you trust a company that can't even acknowledge the most obvious case of corporate crime? How can you trust them? How can you begin to cooperate with them and make them a primary partner of the United Nations?
You also gave awards to cigarette companies, for example, Philip Morris.
Well, actually, we actually gave a booby prize to Philip Morris, because even though they spend more on advertising their philanthropy than they do on the philanthropy, they really haven't fooled anybody. I think everybody knows that they're a killer company, and that so they really get the booby prize for not having fooled anybody. I mean, greenwash is about fooling people, and they just haven't done a very good job.
Who got Best Director?
Best Director went to Lee Raymond of ExxonMobil, the CEO of ExxonMobil, for being such a tough guy and just not really caring about the environment at all.
We're talking to Kenny Bruno. He is co-author of the book EarthSummit.biz, The Corporate Takeover of Sustainable Development. The United Nations agencies also did not escape your awards and your notice. Can you talk about the role specifically of the UN?
Well, Secretary General Kofi Annan has asked all UN agencies to cooperate and partner with the private sector. And it's understandable that agencies like the UN Development Program and Environment Program and UNICEF, because they're not well-funded by governments, are seeking private sector funding for their activities. But sometimes they take things to a ridiculous extreme. For example, UNICEF, which is the world's leading advocate for children, and I considered myself a partner of UNICEF when I was a kid and went around collecting pennies. But now they're partnering up with McDonald's. And it varies in different countries. But in the U.S., for example, we're probably going to see those little orange penny boxes in McDonald's. So the kids will go, you know, Daddy, Daddy, can we go to McDonald's again? I promise to put some pennies in the box or something like that. I think a lot of Democracy Now! Listeners would agree that McDonald's is not necessarily a business that's very good for children. So why the heck is UNICEF partnering with them? So we gave a special McPartnership Award to UNICEF and McDonald's.
So overall, what came out of this conference, the Earth Summit? And overall, in terms of corporations, would you say they gained power out of this? And if so, why did George Bush refuse to go?
I think the significance of the conference was not only that it went backwards from Rio and sort of solidified the United Nations as a rubber stamp or baby brother to the WTO, but that people turned a corner. For the first time on August 31st, there was an anti-globalization march that targeted not the WTO, not the World Bank, not the World Economic Forum, not specific corporations. It actually was targeting the UN itself. That's a very sad day for the UN when it becomes painted with the same brush as the WTO. So I think, but on the upside is that within that movement, for those of us who consider ourselves part of the global justice movement, there was a tremendous energizing feeling that people from the United States, from Europe, from the North, who've been criticized for not representing the poor, were together with people from Soweto and from the township of Alexandria. And there's tremendous unity in that movement, and the energy was growing.
What is the focus of the resolve of where you're headed now?
It's to go back to that movement, to the anti-globalization or anti-corporate globalization movement, and to build our power up from the ground. We don't accept the idea that we have to cooperate and partner with the private sector or with giant transnational corporations to get where we want to go. We're going to have public-public partnerships and partnerships among our own organizations transnationally. I mean, the corporations have transnational reach, and now our movement is going to have transnational reach as well.
Kenny Bruno, his book, Earth Summit Biz, the corporate takeover of sustainable development. Where did the imminent or the current bombing of Iraq and its intensification fit into this, all being held against the backdrop of this?
I think one of the really sad things that was evident in Johannesburg was that they really do still hate us. And to paraphrase my senator, Charles Schumer, but last fall we had a chance to take our foot off the world's neck and without people jumping on us, because there was a lot of sympathy for us. But through our actions since then, people have forgotten about September 11th outside of the U.S. to a large extent, and they're really focused on U.S. arrogance and U.S. bullying, and they really resent us deeply. It's a very uncomfortable feeling for U.S. citizens over there. The bombing of Iraq, the attack of Iraq, and all this, which is so unpopular and so, people just can't even conceive of why we would do this, is going to make it a lot worse.
Thank you for being with us, Kenny Bruno. And as we wrap up today's program, a welcome to KCBS in the Seattle area that is joining us, a community radio station there, and also to all of the public access TV stations that are now watching us live on their public access cable stations. You too can get us, Democracy Now!, on your local public access TV station just by calling them and telling us about us. You can get more information at democracynow.org. If you'd like to order a video or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. And again, we'll be doing special programming on September 11th. And if you would like to let us know what you're doing on September 11th, you can call and leave us a message at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. Or you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke. We also had help from Alex Wolf. Mike DiFilippo is our engineer and music maestro, filling in for Anthony Reparations Sloan, and we very much hope he comes back to us soon and recuperates. Democracy Now! Is your community radio, international and national human rights news hour. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Somebody tell me what's to wear. Tell a woman, have you heard? Come to Johannesburg.